On this episode of Skeptico, Christian Science writer Denise O'Leary on the compatibility of Christian doctrine and new discoveries in human consciousness.
When people have a genuine mystical experience, they generate theta waves while they are awake, which are normally generated during deep sleep. So what he discovered is when they said, "I felt very unusual, it wasn't like a normal experience," they're telling the truth, they're not imagining it.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and before we start in with my interview with Christian Science writer Denise O'Leary, I wanted to take a minute and give you a non-update of the medium experiment. I say non-update because we kind of got about halfway into trial three and then decided to revamp things substantially, including adding a new voicemail system for mediums to use. So I'll have more information for you on that in just a couple weeks. Also, a quick update on the Psychic Detective Project I've been working on with Ben Radford. We have been communicating quite a bit and trying to nail that down, and hopefully in a month or two, we'll have a follow-up on that as well. And finally, the Dogs That Know experiment is still out there kicking around, and my one best dog is back in trials, so I hope to have some information on that. It's been very slow going in terms of getting any trials completed. Just kind of normal life stuff for folks makes it hard for them to complete that experiment, apparently. Okay, so kind of a non-update update there, but coming up, I have what I found to be just fascinatingly frustrating conversation with one of the authors of The Spiritual Brain, Denise O'Leary. Welcome to Skeptico, Denise O'Leary. It's a pleasure to have you. We've had a nice email exchange here, and we're going to talk today about the book that you've co-authored titled The Spiritual Brain. But before we get into that, I thought maybe you could tell us a little bit about your bio, your background, what you do up there in Toronto.
I was the faith and science columnist at Christian Week in the mid-90s. And what I noticed was that very few people were paying much attention to the way in which materialist ideas in science were just not panning out. What I mean is, for example, there's no good explanation for the origin of life on Earth, because the most awkward fact is that even though living cells are very complex, life got started almost as soon as the planet cooled. So an explanation that depended on random events doesn't seem to me to have a long shelf life.
Well, you know what? I'm gonna steer us away from that whole thing. Because
from that, okay, you want to talk about what you want. That's just how I got involved.
No, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. And I don't want to cut off that entirely. I just know that that's going to... it's going to shut a lot of people down, and a lot of people feel like that debate just gets into a lot of areas that have a lot of tire marks, both good and bad. But that's
you know what? I don't have a cat in the fight. It wouldn't matter to me, except that I had to face the fact that that a lot of things I was hearing as the assured results of modern science didn't make sense.
Right, and let's... let's fast forward that into the spiritual brain. And who's your co-author on that again?
Mario Beauregard. He's an associate professor of neuroscience at the Université de Montréal, which is the second largest francophone university in the world. And he basically had been studying people who had had spiritual experiences, Carmelite nuns. How he got them to cooperate, I'm not sure, but he and his graduate student, Vance, were very diplomatic, and they got them to cooperate. And they discovered a couple of things that are worth knowing. One is that spiritual experiences, where a person has an experience in which they feel they are contacting a cosmic power outside themselves, are complex experiences, like an experience where you're talking to someone that you know, that you like, right?
Can you define that a little bit, what you mean when you say complex?
A number of brain areas are active. See, if you're having a very simple experience, maybe only one brain area would be active. But if you're having a complex experience, a number are. Now, the only reason that's important is that many people have attempted to argue that spiritual experiences are caused by some kind of a glitch in the brain. This is unlikely under the circumstances, because if it's a complex experience that looks like a normal experience where there are a number of brain areas active, then it's not likely to be a glitch. So whatever is happening, it's not a glitch.
Okay.
That doesn't prove that the person is contacting a power outside themselves. What it means is that it's probably not useful to look for a glitch that explains why they think they are.
Okay. Well, let's take that one step further, because I think we're going to find a lot of common ground in the idea that the materialistic, and I think when you use materialistic, I think you're also encompassing atheistic, because it really is an atheistic worldview that is perpetuated with that materialism that kind of permeates academia.
One needs to be a bit careful there. By the way, Mario discovered something else, which is that people who say that the spirit, I just want to get this in, when people have a genuine mystical experience, they generate theta waves while they are awake, which are normally generated during deep sleep. So what he discovered is when they said, it felt very unusual, it wasn't like a normal experience, they're telling the truth, they're not imagining it or telling people that to get attention. It's actually true.
Right.
Because if you generated those kinds of waves when you were fully conscious, you would be aware of it. I didn't mean to interrupt. I just thought that since that was probably the most surprising finding of his research, I wanted to get it in.
I think those are very interesting points. And I think they're little footprints in the sand, if you will, that tell us that we are not heading in the right direction when we try and dismiss the spiritual experience as being just some glitch in the brain, which is exactly your point, and I'm complete in agreement with you.
And thank you for permitting me to say that. Now, the other thing is, I don't know that it's helpful to make it something about atheists versus, for example, born-again Christians. Because, for example, the Dalai Lama, you know, the head of Tibetan Buddhism, is technically an atheist. His religious system does not require the existence of a god. And he's a big financer of neuroscience research.
I don't think that's a fair... I've talked to a bunch of Buddhists, including interviewing Alan Wallace, who is one of the foremost Buddhist scholars. And I don't think that he would agree, or a lot of Buddhists would agree, in kind of labeling the Dalai Lama or Buddhism in general as being atheistic. And also, I kind of... You know, I don't want to get too far afield, but I think simple words kind of help. And when we start throwing around, you know, euphemisms to kind of get away from the idea, there's a lot of angry atheists out there, and they've had quite a revival with their the books that have come out in the recent years. So I think we know who we're talking about when we talk about the angry atheists. And I think those are the folks who oppose, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, but oppose this idea that materialism is not a complete explanation for the spiritual experience that people are having.
Thank you, Alex. You've pinpointed the matter beautifully. It's not that they're atheists, but that they're materialists. You see, what I meant to say is the Dalai Lama is an atheist, but he is by no means a materialist.
I don't know that he's an atheist, though. I don't have...
Okay, he is an atheist. I'm not saying... Or rather, it's not important to me that he is an atheist because he's not a materialist. So he wouldn't have a problem with the idea that people have a mind that actually exists. The materialist doesn't think that the mind actually exists. He thinks it's an illusion created by the buzz of neurons in the brain.
Absolutely. Absolutely, and we are, yes, and maybe I am taking in the wrong direction because, you know, we are of the same mind about that, and no pun intended, but I think the words can get in the way, and I think that we're trying to refine that. But let's leave that for a minute, because I think...
Okay, yes. I just wanted to make clear, I don't use the word atheist as a term of abuse. I consider it a technical...
See, I do. I do, and I don't feel particularly a need to apologize about it, because I think it clarifies, really, it gets to the heart of the issue that I think we're talking about. And I think that issue is really, really central to the conversation that I wanted to have.
Well, technically, yes. As a matter of fact, technically, for example, the philosopher Plato could have been called an atheist because he dismissed the gods of his day as unworthy of worship. However, anyone who thinks that Plato did not have a sense of the mind obviously doesn't know anything about Platonism.
But right.
Anyway, let's go on. I agree with you.
Okay, because I think there's much to go on, too, and these are topics that you've covered in the book, The Spiritual Brain, and on your excellent blog that kind of is very freewheeling and reaches into a lot of different areas. And here's
the mindful hack.
The mindful hack. Thanks for bringing that to the attention of our listeners there. So some of the topics that come up are prayer, near-death experience, afterlife encounters, all these phenomena that science is wrestling with, you see as evidence for supporting this idea of a non-reducible mind, a mind that can't be reduced to only brain activity. Why don't you elaborate on that a little bit?
I've always felt that the best way to help people understand what their mind is something very simple, and that's the placebo effect. I usually start there. Some people will have had this experience, and others will have heard about it from others. You're sick. You're away from work for a couple of days. I don't know how employment law works where you live, Alex, but here a person has to go to their doctor and get a letter saying this person really is sick. Otherwise, they're going to get their pay doctor, their vacation day doctor, whatever, right? So you're sitting in the doctor's office, and what happens? You start to feel better. You start to feel you're a fraud. You're only pretending to be sick. But when you woke up in the morning, you thought you were at death's door. So what happened? Well, what happened, and this has been studied in a number of research studies, and there's been books, there's been conferences about it. Basically, at least a part of any illness is what your mind thinks is happening. So the reason the person who's sitting in the doctor's office starts to feel better is that their mind accepts that they're going to get better because they're going to get the letter from the doctor and they're going to stay home for a couple of days and rest and not worry about what's happening at work. So suddenly wellness starts to take over. Now, this isn't a physical thing. It's a mental thing.
Right. And I think that whole placebo effect would go a long way towards explaining the mind-body revolution that we've had in science and in medicine for the last 20 years. But I don't think it will ever get us closer to really understanding the potential revolution that we could have on spirituality and consciousness. So the audience that you're talking to will debate that with you, but they're kind of well aware of that. What I'm more interested in are the more challenging consciousness phenomena of near-death experience, of prayer research, and those kind of things that really challenge our idea of both what are the limits and boundaries of consciousness, but also what is this spiritual dimension that keeps cropping up? Is it real? How does it exist, and how do we study it?
Okay, well, as a Roman Catholic Christian, I hold as a doctrine that it's real. So I just want to mention that up front. So if anybody wants to make that a point, then they need to know that I would start with the assumption it was real and work back. However, that wasn't how I got involved with helping to write the book. The first thing I'd start with respect to near-death experience, the findings were a surprise. You see, traditionally there was just death, right? Sometimes when a person died, people would hold a mirror up to their mouth to see if they were still breathing or to see if their heart had stopped. And if their heart had stopped, then they'd put a cloth over their head, right? And that just meant they were dead. Okay. Well, see, modern medicine changed all. So you have people who are technically dead who come back to life because they're on life support, on bypass, as it's called. So the person on cardiac bypass wakes up and says, you know what? I had an experience where I was could hear what you were saying in the operating room, and you said yada yada, and it turns out that's true. And he had to decide whether he wanted to come back or not. And he decided he would come back. So this has all been different and new. To be perfectly honest, I would resist making hard and fast conclusions about what's going on. The only thing I think can be scientifically justified at this point is to say the mind is not bound as closely to the brain as many have believed. If we start with that, we start with something that we can research, if you see what I mean.
And that's very interesting. It's interesting to me that you limit it there, because I really think that the near-death experience is a much greater window into what's really going on. And I think it's a topic that I really wanted to make the heart of this interview, because it's something I'm very curious about. And that is that if you look at the near-death experience and that has now been studied quite extensively in the lab under very controlled medical conditions, and the results are quite astounding. And it's been studied more just by scientists or doctors who have observed it in kind of a more anecdotal thing. But here's the thing. I look at that. I understand why the neurologists look at that data and dismiss it and don't change their position. I understand why the psychologists look at it and they don't want to change their position either. I mean, these guys have built this whole big machine and it's based on this materialistic view. But what I don't understand is why this information and this research doesn't compel Christians. I mean, because if we accept the near-death experience research, and again, I think you have to because it's very compelling, but if you accept it, then you got to start taking the accounts of the near-death experiencers much more seriously. And there's a lot of data there, and that data does seem to kind of coalesce around some central points that are repeated over and over again and have been repeated across culture, across time, in a typical way that would make us want to accept those accounts. And, you know, they really challenge some of the fundamental assumptions and doctrines in Christianity. So what do we do with that?
Okay, well, I'm going to ask you in a minute to explain which assumptions and doctrines they challenge, but I just want to say that a common practice in science, as I know you realize, is to be fairly cautious when asserting a hypothesis. It's not that I want to minimize the importance of near-death experiences when I say what I do. I'm simply saying that if you wanted to start studying them in a scientific way, that the wisest way to begin would be at the base, which is that the mind does not appear to be as closely tied to the brain as has been supposed in the past. So if we say that, then we can move on to what else can we assume to be true that's widely accepted. You know, but like, see, first we need to accept that it's not necessarily true that when the brain ceases to operate, the mind does. That's what the near-death experience essentially shows from a science perspective. Now, if someone wants to go on and make a claim about religion based on the near-death experience, that's fine. There's no problem with their making it. But traditionally, the science of it would require us to look at the relationship between the mind and the brain.
Well,
and that raises the very interesting question of what is the mind? Then, if it can really be independent of the brain, what is it?
Okay, but Denise, I do feel like you're kind of trying to find shelter in that same
shelter
in that same science that.
No, I'm trying to base it.
Base it too, and I'm just saying after 20 years of very solid, compelling near-death experience research that's been assailed by every possible means, ridiculous, really. Counterclaims by materialists and atheists,
okay.
And it's withstood that. I do mm-hmm. think that it good science dictates.
Okay, I don't doubt it.
But I think the accounts that have been recorded by reliable researchers and people who've collected those accounts, I think are very valid in terms of there's many social scientists who would take those accounts and look at them across culture. I mean, we do these kind of things.
But no, fair enough. Yeah, no, I agree with all that. And my only caution is that I sort of like to keep it in the hands of straightforward science. So, because otherwise you could get things happening that you wouldn't want to sponsor.
But straightforward science has, if that's what you want to call mainstream science, they haven't accepted...
Oh, I don't mean the New Scientist. I don't mean the National Enquirer of the pop.
I'm not, that's what I'm referring to. I'm just saying the traditional mainstream scientists do not accept that the near-death experience shows that there's this duality between mind and brain. So,
then they're just not looking at the evidence.
Anyone can say that at any point. That's why I think it's very, when anyone starts pulling this, well, let's be very cautious on the science and all this. Hey, they're value-free science, forget it, in the society we live in. It's very freewheeling, and we all have to draw our own conclusions based on the evidence, and that's what we're doing. But here's the point. If you take those accounts, yeah, they do undermine the basic doctrine of Christianity.
Well, in
the fundamental way that Christians don't seem to have any special place in this all-loving, merciful light that absorbs so many of these near-death experiencers. There doesn't seem to be any noticeable difference between a Christian or a Jew or a Muslim or a Buddhist. There isn't, and that's what we would expect to see. And moreover, the spiritual figures that often find these folks or help accompany them on their path are different depending on their cultural background.
But why would anybody be surprised by that?
Oh, I think Christians would be very surprised by that if they fully accepted that, because maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I was brought up in a Greek Orthodox tradition, although I'm not of that persuasion now. But everything I heard never accounted for the fact that there is no special place for Christians in heaven, if we want to throw that word out there.
Well, okay. My understanding is that he who does the will of the Father is my mother and my brothers. That's what Jesus said about people who...
Great. I love your interpretation of the Bible. It's awesome.
Well, okay. No, but I'm just saying that's the one I was raised on. There's no reason to expect from the Christian tradition, at least from the early Christian tradition, and certainly from the one I was taught, that anything matters as much as actually doing what you're supposed to do as a Christian. And if whether people do it knowing they're supposed to do it or not knowing they're supposed to do it, and sometimes worrying they're not supposed to do it, wouldn't really matter.
Hold on, well, let's take that. We're going to have a religious discussion here that we've never had on this show, but it's very interesting. Because take what you just said there, and I'm going to reinterpret that and say that belief in Jesus Christ as your personal Savior is not necessary to enter into heaven. That's how I would interpret what you just said, and I think that is fundamentally opposed to at least 90% of the Christians that I know down here in the United States.
Okay, I don't know where you live. Here's what I'm going to say from the perspective of the Catholic Christian tradition. Catholics believe that Jesus Christ, by his sacrifice on the cross, purchased salvation for people, whether they know it or not. Obviously, from my perspective as a Catholic, it's better if people understand than if they don't understand. But the idea that not understanding would mean they couldn't be saved would seem wrong to me.
I'm just saying, if that's your interpretation of the Roman Catholic doctrine as you understand it, I've just never heard such a liberal interpretation that doesn't require or at least recommend Jesus as a means of kind of practicing the faith. And I think that is fundamentally one of the things that we get out of the near-death experience. And I can add the prayer research that's been done where we have, Buddhist monks and people of different faith trying to grow yeast in a petri dish through intention and in prayer. And what we're finding is that your spiritual orientation, your religion, doesn't seem to have any effect on these experiments or these experiences. And you're telling me that's completely in line with Christian thought, but I don't think that's Christianity.
Right. Well, now, just a minute. If Buddhist monks can cause yeast to grow more by praying about it, all that demonstrates is precisely what I think we both suspect, that the mind is not as closely attached to the brain as we think, and that mental events have an influence on our environment. It doesn't demonstrate that the Buddhist interpretation of the nature of reality is more correct or less correct than the Christian interpretation.
Okay, then let's switch back to the near-death experience thing, because that gets more to the...
You know, I'm just saying that we need to be clear about this. That only demonstrates that the mind has power, and I think we both...
Yeah, right. I don't know that level of precision on that one point is as fundamental to what we're talking about.
Okay, well, maybe it isn't, but if it was, that's all it would demonstrate.
Okay. I still don't feel like I have an answer on that last point. If we're saying that there is no difference in reaching heaven, no matter what your spiritual orientation or beliefs are, I just don't see how, as a Christian, you can say that's in line with Christian doctrine.
Okay. From a Christian perspective, understanding who Jesus is and what he does and did will help a person very much. But that doesn't mean they could not be saved without it, which is a different matter. It's like the difference between knowing where the lifeboats are stored and somehow surviving the fact that your ship went down.
You're just not coming through to me there. I mean, so when you walk into church, have you ever heard a priest, a bishop, a cardinal say, you know, this Bible that we have, it's not really that important, it doesn't really matter. And certainly belief in Jesus is not important. All that matters are your good deeds and your good heart.
Of course not.
Well,
you obviously have never been to my church when the scriptures are read. It's a vast ritual. The thing is, a thing can be very, very important, but yet God may contrive someone's salvation without any of the methods that we normally use. So if someone says to me, is my Muslim friend who died trying to rescue someone in a swimming pool saved, I would say, I will pray for that.
Yeah, but then, Denise, switch into the science mode and switch your science hat on and say, okay, from all these near-death experience accounts, even if you put it like you do, that, hey, which I don't agree with, but hey, you know, maybe God is, you know, cutting this guy a slack, even though he's a Muslim. There doesn't seem to be any evidence that there's any difference. There would be a difference. There would be, oh, Christians are kind of let in at a faster rate or something like that. There isn't any of that. If anything, it suggests exactly the opposite.
Well, wait a minute. Have you been to heaven? How do you know? All I'm trying to say is, I don't know about that. I reasonably believe, and I think the history of the influence of Christians in social betterment worldwide would tend to support it, that, in fact, it is better to be a Christian, but that doesn't mean that no one else can be saved. It just means it's easier if you accept certain things up front. For example, some religions teach that God is very forbidding, and you can't tell what he's going to do. But we Christians believe God is our Father and loves us and wants us to be saved. I would say that psychologically that was better.
Well, that's a claim. That's a different claim that we won't even get into.
Okay, cause... I'm just saying, since you're asking me, I'm telling you. Now, I don't have the advantage you have of having studied near-death experiences for many years. I only looked at them fairly briefly in connection with my work on the spiritual brain, but enough to convince me there was something there.
I encourage you to read the accounts, and I encourage all Christians...
I have read a number.
Well, I encourage all Christians to read the accounts, because they're very moving, they're very spiritual. But I can't really accept what you're saying. I don't see how anyone can really read those accounts and then walk straight into Christian doctrine and not feel that they've kind of lost something. And as long as we're kind of on this mode, there are similar accounts, incredibly compelling accounts of past life work. And this has come up over and over again and by different means. And so there's another area of potential research that, again, doesn't that contradict Christian doctrine? And are Christians open to exploring the limits of understanding consciousness by whatever means. You brought up the Dalai Lama a while ago, and I've often wondered why Christians haven't taken the same position that the Dalai Lama has regarding science, because I think it's the perfect position, and it switches this whole science versus religion thing around. And you may know this, but the Dalai Lama has very famously come out and said, I fully support any scientific findings on the beliefs or the teachings of Buddhism. And if science proves any of our beliefs or our teachings are wrong, then Buddhism must change because we are about discovering the truth. I just have never heard that kind of openness from the Christian community. It's always a more defensive, you haven't proved anything that I believe wrong kind of thing.
Well, I'm not sure they could in the case of the Christian tradition. But in any event, well, now you mentioned reincarnation. I assume
Correct.
That's what you mean by past lives. My sense is that the big problem that people are going to have is to establish that reincarnation shows that people actually inhabited past bodies and not simply that they had access to the mental state.
Right, but are you familiar with the work that's been done, originally done by Ian Stevenson, has now been followed up by a number of folks at the University of Virginia?
No, I've been, you know, I keep up with that when I can. I'm just saying that's my only comment about it, that I'm not saying...
But Denise, are you familiar with the work where they've actually looked at birthmarks, unusual birthmarks at entry points where the person had a knife wound or a bullet wound, and many of those correspond. So again, you can hold.
No, well, then obviously there's something going on there. But all I'm saying is that there's probably more than one model that might explain what was happening. The one thing I always come back to, because I think it's a base, if you like, of responsible research, is that the mind is not as closely linked to the brain as has been formerly thought. So that way, one can move out into an area that's well-sourced without attracting a whole bunch of, well, you know, cranks. Because we do need to admit that this sort of research, any sort of research like this, and I include that in the Christian community as well as others, could attract cranks. So that's why some of us tend to try to be fairly baseline.
I really have to take issue with that because I think it's a strategy that folks in the parapsychology and in the other alternative conscious community have tried to do. You know, have tried to kind of bow to the altar of materialism and say, no, we just want our little piece over here. And I think it's a failed strategy.
You're the first person who has ever suggested that I was bowing to anyone like that, but do go on.
Well, I kind of do. I mean, I think the evidence for near-death experience, I think, is overwhelmingly compelling. And I think
hold on,
let me finish. And then to say that we can only take that evidence so far because we can only say that we can chip away at the materialistic paradigm, I just think isn't the way to proceed. I think the way we would proceed if we were really on a level footing without the baggage of the paradigm that we had, as soon as we established that first fact, we'd start digging through the accounts. And our social scientists would then go look at those accounts, and they'd look at them across culture, across time, and they'd do all the kind of analysis they do, and then they'd come back and tell us what some of those accounts mean. I don't see that as fringe. I don't see that as fringe in the least. I think when you have...
No, I don't think it is either, but I'm just saying that... for example, one author for whose work I had considerable respect, now I just wish I could think of the name of his book, but he studied near-death experiences in the southern United States, and he made a practice of not interviewing anyone who had told their story to a large media audience. He only talked to people who had communicated privately with physicians and others. You know, I'm just saying... I think I can see a role for caution in these matters. I thought his caution well justified, and I found his book quite good.
Well, there's really but I think you can easily move into a mode where you have two different forms of science. There's really only one form of science. There's good science and there's bad science. And there really isn't anything in between. It's like this whole idea of extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof. That's really bull. It should be thrown out the window. It should be buried with all the other old axioms that get thrown around. What is extraordinary evidence? What is extraordinary proof? In the terms of near-death experience, which I don't want to get hung up on. I'm going to do a whole series of shows on it. But the evidence is really overwhelming. To claim that that isn't is really an extraordinary claim. Let me move it into the past life thing, because a lot of people think that that's so fringe. Well, you have many, many practitioners, highly credentialed. You have Brian Weiss, who's an Ivy League MD at a university and is using hypnotherapy with his patients and suddenly starts regressing people and they're going back to these past lives and he just feels like he can't ignore it. And at this point, you know, he's done tens of thousands of these. You have other very well-credentialed, competent folks in this field who, if not for the taboo nature of what they're claiming, we'd be all over studying that. So that's why I'm a little bit resistant to this idea that, oh, we have to move so cautiously. No, we have to move at the appropriate level of caution as to make sure that the science is good. But we don't have to move slower.
No, I would agree with that. But I'm just saying that often that means moving fairly cautiously in the sense that one does not want to multiply hypotheses beyond what you can very strongly base. We know that there is a near-death experience. Now, apparently, some people, from what you're telling me, have access to information about other people's lives who are dead, who you can't account for how they have that information. As I say, I must insist, the furthest I'd be prepared to go is simply to say that the mind is obviously not closely bound to the brain, and every subsequent hypothesis needs to be based on that, if you see what I mean. That doesn't mean you can't have a hypothesis. I don't care whether your hypothesis agrees with my religious convictions or not. I'm just saying it must be, hypotheses must be based on each other.
Yeah, maybe. It just kind of sounds like you're, again, maybe letting your religious doctrine kind of drive some of that. These should be issues scientifically that should be on the forefront of Christian thought. They really should.
Well, maybe. I'm not at the forefront of Christian thought. I'm just a science journalist who happens to be Catholic. But I agree that it would be very interesting to study it. The biggest problem for Christians worldwide, by the way, is religious persecution. Did you know that?
But take a statement like that. The biggest problem for Christians is religious persecution. Is that a scientific claim? Well, then we'd have to define problem. We'd have to define persecution. And then we'd have to define Christendom. And what is Christianity? Because I think, despite what you've said, I don't think that what we've just agreed on would be accepted by the wide, wide, vast majority of Christians in terms of the place that Jesus Christ plays in the kind of spiritual hierarchy. And I know you're not willing to go there based on the data that you have so far, but if that is a working hypothesis, I think that changes Christianity in a fundamental way, and then it calls into question, you know, who's being persecuted and who's being prejudiced against, and all those other things are up for grabs.
Okay, in my own country, there are big problems for Christians in the sense that the Human Rights Commissions have taken a number of cases against Christians who were simply enunciating the doctrines of their churches and so forth. There is a big problem, but it doesn't matter. All I'm trying to say is that most Christians wouldn't really care much about reincarnation because in so many places the big problem is just to live at peace with one's neighbors.
Not to me. Anyways, because I don't understand why there isn't a burning desire among spiritual people to find the truth and to push for the truth. And there doesn't seem to be. And I would say in this conversation, I'd say you're a very, very open person. And I appreciate the dialogue greatly. And it's very helpful to
what do you take the truth to be?
I think science and the scientific method is a wonderful gift. It's a gift that we've been given to penetrate as far as we're able towards the truth. And I think my read of it is that Christianity as a whole has been complicit in how this great gift has really been hijacked. And it's been hijacked by the materialists, and the Christians haven't done a good job of getting it back. And the only way to get it back is the position, I think, that's best enunciated by the Dalai Lama, that says, hey, whatever we want to prove, we don't want to just sit back and say, which I always often hear Christians saying is, oh, you can't prove anything I think is wrong. No, it has to be saying, no, I want to know the truth. I want to push science to its limits to understand if what I believe is true. And I think the consciousness studies that we're on the verge of trying to understand can provide a window into, I think they already have, but they can provide a window into knowing what's true. And I don't know, I don't understand why thoughtful Christian people aren't on the forefront of that.
Well, some are.
Who?
Well, Jeffrey Schwartz.
Who's Jeffrey Schwartz?
Oh, he's a neuropsychiatrist and the author of The Mind and the Brain. I mean, yes, of course there are a lot of people like that. Why shouldn't there be? The thing is, I guess all I meant was that I can understand why you wish more Christians were involved with that. It's just that worldwide, Christians in all walks of life were involved in different things.
Of course, of course. But we're talking now about the leadership. When we talk about the Dalai Lama, we're talking about the spiritual leader of the Buddhist tradition, and we don't see anything on that scale in any denomination of Christendom coming forward and really saying that, you know, these discoveries that we're making in consciousness can help us better understand the validity of these doctrines. And I think that's a failing of Christianity. And I think it will wind up furthering this divide between science and religion, when really what we need is a joining of science and religion.
Well, you know, you might be interested then in some of Benedict the 16th's statements and pronouncements. There is various things going on at the Vatican, as a matter of fact, including right now an assessment of origins of life, which I realize isn't directly your issue, but anything they were going to say about human consciousness would likely be founded step by step on stuff like that. So
I think that, you know, back circling back maybe to the point that we started on, and maybe we can kind of wrap it up there. Mm-hmm. But I don't understand that either. I don't understand what consciousness is fundamental to the issue of the origins of life, as you well know, you know. But as soon as you separate out the idea that that consciousness is this, has this dualistic nature, we don't know when it begins, we don't know when it ends, we don't know what's necessary, we don't know what's sufficient to cause it. As soon as we fully address those issues, well then, original life is completely up for grabs, because what is life? And it also challenges the social issues that seem to be at the center of the Christian thought in terms of abortion and stem cell and all that. Those are all up for grabs too, because we don't know where those fall. But again, I don't see Christians leading the charge and saying, well, you know what, we're not really sure what the position should be on abortion. We need to understand what consciousness is all about. We don't understand what the position should be on stem cell. We need to understand more about consciousness. That's not what I hear.
Well, no, that wouldn't be a Christian position anyway.
But the Christian position should just be whatever science, whatever real science tells us, that's the direction we go, because that's as close as we can get to truth.
I'm not sure, because fundamentally you have to decide whether the unborn child matters or not. And that is basically...
Fundamentally you have to decide what a child is. And I think where that really comes down to is consciousness.
Not necessarily.
But for most of us, we make a distinction in our lives between that which is conscious and that which isn't. We give more significance. I mean, this is, I don't even want to get into it. It's a whole thing. But I mean, a rock, we assume, doesn't have consciousness. A dog, we does. We tend to give special privileges to dogs over rocks. So I think consciousness is fundamental to that debate. And anyone who doesn't think so, I just don't know where they're coming from.
Well, having raised several children, I would have to say that I don't believe that two-month-old children are conscious in any normal way.
I do. Having raised four, I think they are.
Okay, that's fine. You can believe it. I didn't observe it, and I've looked after many children. But I'm just saying that it would never have occurred to me to judge human rights on the basis merely of consciousness. Although I agree that consciousness is an important aspect of the human experience.
Central. I mean, to me, it's so trumps everything else that, you know, if you don't start with consciousness, it doesn't even make any sense to talk about the rest of it. It's an 80-20 rule. But yeah, there's other things that I guess you'd have to factor in there. But until you understand consciousness, you don't have a hope of understanding, in my opinion. Just
okay. But however, in deciding how to help fellow human beings, I would not have thought trying to determine how conscious they were was the best approach. That's all I'm trying to say. I don't think the Christian tradition is likely to move in that direction, because the fact that they're fellow human beings, period, creates a claim on us. Their degree of consciousness is, of course, going to vary.
Well, that's maybe a whole different issue. I mean, I think everyone is. All human beings, and I think, you know, animals are bestowed with consciousness and this ability that is different from the brain. But hey, I don't know that. My main point is those are areas of research that don't receive enough attention. And I think, you know, we're probably in agreement. We're in agreement on so many things. But it's fun and interesting to really kind of highlight the points where maybe we don't totally come together in terms of our view of the world. But I greatly, greatly appreciate you taking the time today, Denise. And we'll certainly have links to your book.
Yes, please do let me know, because I'll link to our interview at The Mindful Hack.
The Mindful Hack, yes.
Yeah,
it's a very interesting blog that's out there. Yeah, I'll be in touch with all that. We'll have a transcript up as well as the audio version of it.
Mm.
Delightful talking to you.
Well, same here, and have a wonderful day.
Thanks again to Denise O'Leary for joining me today on Skeptico. If you'd like information on her book or links to her website, please visit the Skeptico website. That's Skeptiko. You'll also find links to all our previous shows, our forum, and an email link where you can drop me a note. That's going to do it for today. Stay with us in the future. Much, much more to come. Until then, bye for now.